The booming market for hemp seed in Australia has spurred on a new wave of growers in Tasmania. The state already produces almost two-thirds of the nation's commercial hemp crop, and that figure is set to grow on the back of increased demand and a supply shortage in mainland Australia. Larissa Smith caught up with a couple of the industry's newest entrants.
At Campbelltown in Tasmania's northern Midlands, the harvester is slowly mowing down David Taylor's hemp crop. It's separating the oil-rich seed out of the hemp heads. Now, the crop itself is nearly 2 metres tall, so it's a slow process.
It's the first time I've grown. It is reasonably even. It's probably a little bit higher than I was expecting. I was hoping to try and keep the height down a little bit just to make harvesting more consistent and less stubble to deal with.
What sort of gains are you looking for when it comes to returns over any other crop that you might have put in that paddock?
We try and keep things reasonably simple here. We basically do livestock and poppies, and we do a little bit of fodder grazing crops around that. But the thing I liked about it was the growing period. I mean, we have done spuds in the past, but I get nervous with spuds that because down in the Campbelltown region along this valley, our ground is quite sandy, so it is good spud growing ground. But one of the problems that I've been watching is that the harvesting time is getting later and later. My next door neighbour's still harvesting potatoes in June and possibly early July, but certainly very late in the season, and eventually it does get wet, plus you don't get your paddock back. But one of the selling points for me was that the 100-day or 110-day crop. So in, out, and you get your paddock back, and you can then use it for fodder going into the winter.
So as a first-time grower and looking to be part of the industry long-term, how important is it to a rotation to have those options?
Obviously, potatoes and poppies have been part of the Tasmania's cropping backbone for a long time, as well as the cereal crops. But I prefer the livestock poppy mix, but this one, I think, given the short growing season, it does work with my livestock operation reasonably well. So from that point of view, I think it's quite positive, and that's for me personally. But the agricultural industry in Tasmania, economically, I think another option for growers out there that gives them access to new markets on the mainland. I know that Tasmania's this clean green food image. I think this product works in pretty well with that too.
These are pretty good heads, so seem to have a lot of seed in them. Yeah, and I think the harvest is pretty close, so we'll know the verdict in a day or two.
In the southern Midlands at York Plains, wool grower Stuart Burberry has also planted hemp for the first time.
It fitted the bill pretty well into our rotation, so yeah, we've got a winter feed gap out in our area, and the hemp fits in well because we can winter sheep on the ground and then spray the ground out and put it in October, November, and yeah, it works well that way.
When did it go in?
20th of November, off the top of my head, yeah, roundabout date. So, yeah, went in then, and we just direct drilled into an oat stubble, into pretty good moisture, and didn't irrigate for about the first 5 weeks. But then, yeah, it progressively got a bit drier the season, and, well, we've put about 1.8 meg to the hectare on this crop, so, yeah, it's come out pretty well.
What are the gross margins? What are the returns that you're hoping to get from this crop to make money from it more than just break even?
Yeah, well, we're contracted at $3.10 a kilo. Yeah, overheads are looking at probably somewhere around about the $1,300 to $1,400 a hectare to grow. So, yeah, we'd like to be netting a couple of hectare out of it, a couple of grand a hectare. So, yeah, if it can do that, we'll definitely keep going with it. We need to get more hectares of ground to have a really viable industry. And if we can get enough hectares, we'll get a good market for the residue products out of it. So, yeah, if we can find a good market for the residue and remove the residue off our paddocks, well, that'll be a big plus for everyone, I think.
This year I've been in every paddock that I've contracted every week, so it's been a little bit hectic driving between York Plains and Smithton every week.
Ted Jones is with Red Agriculture. It's a new company that's contracting growers on behalf of Geelong-based manufacturer Australian Primary Hemp.
It's been a very interesting process for the first-time growers. Generally, if you can grow poppies, you can grow hemp. If you can grow grain and you have a free-draining soil with the addition of irrigation, you're definitely suitable to have a hemp crop on your property for this coming year.
Where will this hemp seed end up from this farm here near Campbelltown?
It'll end up at our receival depot where it will be dried and cleaned and graded, and then it will be, once we do a food grade test on that, passes the test results, which usually take about 10 to 14 days for those results to come back, then it will be shipped to Geelong and will be processed there. Well, they will do the de-hulling and outsource the cold pressing for the small grain.
How much more hemp seed would they like out of Tasmania?
They would love to be able to achieve somewhere between 1,500 and 2,000 tonnes, which would equate to around 2,000 hectares.
That's the total amount of hectares that I think the industry collectively would like to grow next season.
Yes, at the moment the demand for Australian grown hemp seed far outstrips the supply. So regardless of what company's growing it, the demand for Australian grain is very high.
So I'm Felipe Favaro and I'm General Manager of Hemp Foods Australia. We are now moving from only supplying, you know, the ingredients to consumers such as hemp seed, hemp oil, hemp protein powder, hemp flour, and now we are moving to be able to supply all the experiences, because the consumers still don't know really how to consume hemp, right? So we have, last year we launched like a hemp snack bar, and we are about to launch hemp burgers, so another three flavors, so hemp falafel, hemp and beetroot, and hemp and tofu. Soon you're gonna
all be vegetarian then.
All vegetarian, yes. This is a trend. I think hemp is the studies, a lot of vegetarian people consume hemp, but it is in the plan that, you know, we might be able one with non-vegetarian as well. Yeah, to non-vegetarian consumers. I think first we need to bring farmers to grow hemp at first, so they have to have a goal to grow hemp. So the unconventional is the, you know, is the first step, right? But we want to, you know, we're going to keep pushing for the certified organic, because we, in the end, we want to see in a few years down the track the, you know, the farmer migrating to more, towards more organic production. But you know, this is a journey, and it's just the beginning. So, but that's the vision, that's the goal, that's the plan.
Philippe Favaro, General Manager of Hemp Foods Australia, ending Larissa Smith's report. Now, when millions of fish suffocated to death in the Darling River this summer, its traditional owners, the Barkindji, declared that they too were getting sick as the river's health declined. The vexed and vitriolic debate about water use through the entire Murray-Darling Basin has remained at fever pitch for months as water flowing into the system dries up. On the other side of the country in WA's north, the state government is looking at allowing anywhere up to 600 gigalitres, or 6 billion litres of water, to be harvested from the Fitzroy River for irrigation. Just like the rivers in the Murray-Darling Basin, the Fitzroy River, which cuts an arc across the northern tip of the state, is of extreme cultural importance to the traditional owners. And while they do see some opportunity in the scheme, they're also warning the state government not to repeat the mistakes basin states have made. Here's Nakina woman, Dr. Anne Polina.
When we look at the Murray-Darling Basin, one of the big issues was the voices of Indigenous people. And their knowledge systems was absent from the planning and the evaluation process. So it's very important that Aboriginal people, particularly because we've got such extensive knowledge in regards to the well-being of the system, we need to make sure that, that's in there. But we also, as the council, need to be able to get independent science ourselves in regards to helping us to understand some of these concepts, because they're very big concepts, and so Aboriginal people need a time to sit around and talk about, what are we talking about when we're talking about cultural water? What are we talking about when we're talking about sustainable water development? What are we talking about when we're talking about a strategic Indigenous reserve of water? And what do we actually mean when we're starting to look at all of this scenario around Aboriginal economic development?
That's Nakina woman, Dr. Anne Polina. This week, Aboriginal leaders from basin states travelled to the west to offer some advice to WA traditional owners there. Lower Darling River's Indigenous Nations Acting Chairman Grant Rigney spoke with reporter Courtney Fowler.
The first thing for me is about the over-allocation of a system itself. What we don't, the non-Indigenous peoples in Australia that don't understand, water is a living body. Water is an entity in its own right. But we see it as a commodity, and we use it as a commodity instead of looking at it as a living, breathing thing. and that's what it is. And they have gone down that pathway in New Zealand with one of the river systems over there, that the river has legal rights. The Murray-Darling Basin is an over-allocated system, and still is today. We're seeing the impacts, as Badger was saying, on the Barker, with no water whatsoever coming down, because it's over-allocated in the north, and it's over-allocated within New South Wales itself. And the big problem is that most of these systems have been politically driven. And internationally, Australia's Murray-Darling Basin Plan is seen as the best plan in the world for water reform. But yet, we see the issues and the problems we're having there, and a lot of it still boils down to that the states themselves have constitutional powers and have powers by their own law to give out licences, where it doesn't actually match the bipartisan support that they have on the Murray-Darling Basin Plan itself. The water is not there, but yet they're still allocating licences out. So, you know, it's very problematic. And the issue for me is that the federal government need to be stepping in and saying that is not viable. We are going to override the state in that law by using our Australian constitution for the best interests of the country, but they are not doing that. And what we're trying to share with our brothers and sisters up here in the Kimberley is that these are the things that are impacting on the Murray-Darling Basin, and you need to be quite well aware of it, that these things could actually eventuate here in the Kimberley itself.
What do you make then of four West Australian ministers flying up to Fitzroy Crossing to discuss with all members of the community the future of the river here in Fitzroy? Is that the sort of move that you think is crucial to keep everyone in the conversation?
It is a starting point, and these things need to be talked about, and it's great to see that the ministers are up here talking about these particular issues. It actually gives a pathway for the TO groups up this way to voice their concerns in these areas. What comes out of it might be a completely different story.
Barkindjie Elder William Badger Bates has also travelled across to Fitzroy Crossing to tell his story to traditional owners in the Kimberley. He grew up along the riverbank near Wilcannia in New South Wales, which is not far from the Menindee Lakes, where millions of fish recently died from lack of oxygen in the water. He says he hopes the WA government learns from the Murray-Darling experience and listens to its First Nation people.
They'd get some good advice of what we listened to yesterday, and I hope the minister do listen to us, because in 91, we said the old elders would pass away, now old Barkindjie Elder, they said there'd be no more irrigation on Barkindjie country, no more licences coming to our country, but it just fell on deaf ears. I killed our beloved Barker. Without the Barker, me and my people, I say, I got three mothers. The mother that born me into the world, my grandmother that lent me my culture along with my mother, and then I got the Barker that fed me, so I got three mothers. And I want the Barker to flow for future generations, and not just for my people, but for everyone. And we want the Menindee Lakes on the Ramsar, and we want our cultural water to be stored there and managed by us for everyone. We are at a crisis with me and my people, but we're not going to give up hope. But we said, and I say, we never ever want to see someone else suffer like we did.
The state government here, at the start of the consultation process, there was a similar meeting this time last year. Ministers came out of that meeting confident that they could create a balance between protecting the interests of the river and creating a boost to the local economy here and economic development. Do you see it possible being able to balance those two interests? Could we have prevented the Murray-Darling Basin and still seen agricultural development along the way? Is there a way for it to all exist together?
Absolutely there is. I do firmly believe that. There has to be, and I think there can be, a coexistence in those areas. But it has to be done in a framework that's incorporating the TO group's aspirations and their ideologies of a healthy country and a healthy system. And these are the things that I think the dialogue will be around over the next period of time. As for the Murray-Darling Basin itself, well, we do have a mechanism within the Basin Plan called Aboriginal Values and Uses. It's Chapter 10, Part 14 of the plan. But for me, it is just a very tokenistic measure. We are not involved with the sciences. We are not incorporated into the researches that have been done in those areas. a lot of our nation groups in the Mildrin Confederation, the Murray Lower Darling River Indigenous Nations, which are 28 confederated nation groups from Dubbo to the Murray Mouth in South Australia. We have bodies and nation groups that have research areas that can drive this process in conjunction with Western sciences to get a better future outcome for our next generations. It's not for me to talk about anything on this country. This is not my country, but I would certainly support any of the TO groups up this way in any capacity that we possibly can in helping them. But if the dialogue comes out in a format where they are quite happy with the outcomes of today's meeting, I think that's a good pathway forward.
Lower Darling Rivers Indigenous Nations Acting Chairman Grant Rigney and Barkindji Elder William Badger Bates in Fitzroy Crossing. They were speaking to Courtney Fowler.